very much, Jennifer. What I might do is get the three people who've spoken this morning to come up here and we can do a joint... So Jennifer's covered almost everything there is to cover, brilliantly. both her talk and obviously the other two panellists are here for you to quiz on anything more. Russell.
All of you have touched on this, but perhaps not going into as much depth as I would like. And this is whether or not we have adequate organisational infrastructure to face some of these challenges. So Adam spoke about the need to have more concentration on appropriateness of care and quality of care. Do we have the right organisations to do that? Michael spoke about the private health insurance companies being hamstrung of being able to interact with some of those processes. There are not the right interactions or organisational structures to facilitate that. And then Jennifer highlighted the fact that we've actually abolished a number of agencies. Is that good or bad? Several of them were criticised from within the industry and perhaps not going to be mourned, but others may be essential parts of what we need going forward. So I wonder if I could get the panel to respond to those issues of the organisational infrastructure within the health sector.
I think it's a really good question, Russell, and it's not something I have any expertise in. So I'm probably not the best person to answer it, but I think clearly we don't. I mean, if we did, all these things wouldn't be happening. So I think that's a really good question that we need to answer. What is the organisational infrastructure that we need to address all of the problems that have been raised this morning and the ones that everyone else is aware of? And I think what's important, though, is that when we're looking for solutions, what infrastructure we need, we make sure that that's founded on what our values are as a community. So are we looking for, say, a solution to improving performance of doctors? Is that something that we need to look at just via private health insurance? Is it something across the board so that consumers accessing both public and private services can have some confidence that their healthcare providers are following best practice, not just members of Bupa or Medibank Private?
Thanks, Russell. It is a good question. I sometimes think what first ingredient is necessary is the will, be that political will or otherwise, to actually give the green light to some of these initiatives that otherwise might appear controversial. And the one I think of is in my area, which is the Comprehensive Management Framework of the MBS, which, for those who don't know, there is actually a review process underway within Medicare and looking at the appropriateness of Medicare items. That came about because of change of government some 5, 6, 7 years ago, and it was a very political move. So there needs to be that preemptive political will. But then I think you're right, we have some examples out of the United States. For example, I mentioned the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute in the United States. They've been given a specific charge of trying to focus on what is best for patients, and they're working backwards from that point. They have the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, which is their evidence-based medicine generating engine. And the other thing I think the US has, which is very unique and quite novel, and we wrote about this in a recent NJA paper around what we could learn from the US, is through the Obama administration's funding of various state-based health reforms in the Affordable Care Act, they've established something called the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Innovations Center. And it's really flown under the radar, but it's been funded to the tune of about $2 billion. And their charge is to actually run evaluations in line with different payment reform mechanisms that have been going on, and they're evaluating them for effectiveness and applicability. And I think that's actually something that Australia can learn from very well. The other thing they do through AHRQ is they have a future needs program where they actually go to end users, be they patients, policymakers, and say, what are the big challenges that you have, and what research could we be doing to answer those questions? Within Australia, whether or not we need different agencies or new agencies to do that, I'm completely agnostic. We already have agencies, but I think there could be a conversation about which agencies could be best suited for purpose to do that work.
Russell, I think your question should have been more phrased along the lines of, are our prison organisations unsuitable? And the answer is yes. And if they weren't, we wouldn't be where we are today. But the dilemma, as I see it, and I'm now looking at 40 years of engagement either as a medical practitioner or health minister or my present job, the dilemma is that the people who can change those structures are always government. And the reality of the situation, in my view, I may be wrong, but this is my view, the reality of it is that people actually know what needs to be done, but governments are never going to challenge in a major way. There's never going to be a really major shake-up absent a major crisis, because governments actually want everyone to vote for them. Governments of all persuasions. This is a completely agnostic view of government. You know, no one, where's Mukesh, my good friend Mukesh? No one's going to take on the AMA about some of the ghastly things that I've talked about because they want doctors to vote for them. No one's going to take on the joint manufacturers because they want people to vote for them. No one's going to take on X, Y, and Z because at the end of the day, they want them to vote for them. So I think we are, sadly, very sadly, and I think that might be the import of your question, I think we are stuck with organisations which do an adequate job, but not the best job, and it's up to the whole system to try and focus the governments of all persuasions on improving the outputs that whatever organisation is there can deliver.
Hi, Emily Clay from the Mental Health Platform of Australia. I'd just like to follow on from the previous question. Around organisational infrastructure and capability. We've talked a lot about the public sector and the private sector, but I've also have a question about the role for the community sector in delivery and management and design of health services. I guess in the public sector, we're seeing reductions in public expenditure, obviously, making space, and I think the government's narrative is that that's making space for the private sector and also for the civil society. To move into that space and deliver things more efficiently and more innovatively. But civil society also includes community services, but we're also seeing supports both in an organisational sense as well as being able to deliver the services. We're seeing governments pulling back from supports for community services as well. So I was just curious about the panel's perspective of what the role for community managed organisations could be, and what ideally would be, and what risks there may be to come up, and how they might be managed in the future.
That's a really big question. I'm not going to try and address all of it, but what I would say is yes, the community sector is really important. It is one that often gets ignored for a whole range of reasons. And I think the strength in the community sector is it's often the sector that's closest to consumers. And so what I would say is that the community sector can play a really important role in the current debate by really engaging with consumers and with the community and by promoting their issues and their voice, and making sure that it's heard, you know, throughout the health sector and in Parliament. And the other issue is I think, from my understanding of the government and the discussions that I've had with government ministers, they don't know themselves what they want the community sector to do. I think there's a lot of confusion about where it sits and what it does. So that's frustrating, and it's not great, but it's also an opportunity, I think, for the community sector to kind of write its own brief as far as possible. So I think there's an opportunity there.
Yeah, I would absolutely echo that. I think the example that comes to mind comes from the UK. One of my Arkansas colleagues has taken on the directorship role of Beacon UK, which is a mental health community-based organisation. And essentially they've built that organisation out of being an agitator, positive agitator, but also through demonstrating their value proposition, which required them actually putting some good intellectual thought behind what their value proposition is to the broader community, but also to governments. And that seems to be working quite well. And I think Australia, you're right, doesn't necessarily have a great pedigree it's almost like a disruptive technology in a sense, the idea of these groups really demonstrating what their position is, which requires that advocacy point of view, but also requires the rigor of the academic value proposition that they can bring.
My remit at the moment is not into the community sector. My guy's not allowed to pay for it, so I'll have to feign ignorance about your question directly. But what I would say is I know someone very well. He's an eminent person in my industry who runs an equivalent fund in Spain. And he said, look, I've been doing this for years, but he said it's only when the government changed the funding model and actually gave him funding responsibility, with all the clinical decisions still to be made by clinical people and so on. He said, it's only when I was given the funding responsibility of the total care of a community for 15 years with very strict penalties if I didn't deliver. He said, it's only then that I really got engaged in preventative care, in environmental health measures and so on. Because he said, I knew that I was going to see a direct benefit of what I was doing. At the moment, if I spend money as a fund now on preventative care for Tim, I might spend it for 5 years, and then because I've spent that money, I put up my fees a little bit more, and he jumps ship to Adam's fund. So Adam gets all the benefit, all I've done is pay. So there's actually in the system a disincentive at present. So that's one of the sort of flow-ons from the change in funding model that I would expect or would presume that the government would want, that in fact the dollars that they were spending would be spent on just the sort of things that you're talking about.
Turn back. Rod.
If you're looking at waste in the system or inefficiency, have you looked at the transactional costs of taxpayers' dollars coming from Commonwealth to states to often another provider who often then purchases something from a care manager and eventually a service ends up with the patient? Is that an area of investigation that I'm interested in the other panellists' comment on that too?
Absolutely. It's actually fundamental, particularly in the Australian context or any context where there are multiple payers in healthcare. It probably is a good opportunity for me to also talk about some of the other issues that have been talked about today in the sense that we think about reforming. There's also a lot of talk around reforming integrated care, so building integrated care models and the like. And then there's an automatic discussion around who should be funding what, starting with the funders and moving forward, whether it's private health insurance, what is the role of private health insurance and primary care and whatnot. I actually don't take that perspective at all, because I think that automatically sets you up for a combative relationship around talking about the role of those funders. I prefer to kind of flip that and think about, well, what are the needs of the patient, and let's work backwards from the needs of the patient. And I think once you start to take that flipped perspective and work backwards, it might actually turn out that primary health insurance is the perfect person to be involved in primary care, but you don't start at that position, you start at what's best for the patient. And I think as you do that, you actually learn that there are enormous transactional costs throughout the process that, when they come to light, just demonstrate more the opportunity cost that's evident in wasteful healthcare. So I hope that sort of answers your question.
I'm fascinated. I presume by waste you don't mean the sort of thing that we sometimes get billed for dentists to take out the same tooth four times. My funds, when I first came into this job, I asked some what I thought were some fundamental questions. And one of the issues that is interesting to me, and I hope it is to you, the for-profit funds, and I know that some of them are the bête noire of people in this room, the for-profit funds actually have much lower transactional costs than the not-for-profits. And I asked the people why that is, and they said, Michael, it's because we're for-profit. And in fact, if you analyse the for-profits versus the not-for-profit funds, it's often the for-profits that have a very low management expense ratio. Their premium increases are often in the middle of the pack rather than at the high end. So I think from the private sector's perspective, waste is something that the funds desperately try to avoid at the drop of a hat.
So, thank you. I've got a couple of questions, if I may. Just going back to the issue of private health insurance and your role in judging policy or paying for quality, can I ask who, in your mind, what ought to be the judges of that quality, and does that not in some way contradict the current move to abolish the independent hospital pricing authority and the hospital performance authority? So that's question number one. And I guess related to that is also the expansion of private health insurance in relation to the coverage. What do you see as the role of government to almost regulate further the role of private health insurance so they don't take the path of least resistance, and that, in other words, to expand into areas of greater affluence in the eastern suburbs of Sydney as opposed to the rural and remote parts of Australia, because there are very limited private health insurance hospitals available anyway?
Thank you. Second question first. Look, we can't do anything about the rural and remote hospital gap because we don't run hospitals. I mean, I have to say, it sounds like I'm ducking the question, but it's factual. And we know that people will join private health insurance funds if there's ready access to a private facility. And so we don't provide hospital care. So that's more a question for Ramsay or Healthscope or the Catholic health sector or someone. But you know, all we do is pay for care once it's provided in a hospital. So I think that's critical. Who might judge quality? This is a dream. This is not something that we're advocating for directly right at the moment. So I don't think I'm revealing a secret plan of the private health insurance industry. In my view, clinicians ought to do it. But should it be clinicians who are directly engaged now in providing healthcare? And I think the answer is no. And what I would do is I would try to set up, and I know that there are hundreds of clinicians around Australia in this circumstance who would love to do it, whom one might call clinical elders, highly respected people who have made a decision to be less clinically involved, and in my view, the system, if it wanted to look at it, could set up a gateway or a pathway such that if any clinician was able to convince a body of his peers, his or her peers, that the treatment was appropriate and it was of high quality, we should pay for it. If they can't convince their peers that it's of high quality, or even worse, that it's inappropriate, I come back to the question you asked, why should I pay for that? So what I'm in no way saying that health insurance funds should determine what is paid for. But I come back to one of the slides which said, we just want to pay for quality, we just want to pay for stuff that's really, really necessary. And I think until we address how we might do that, we are going to keep on paying for 7 repeat hip operations for that woman in Adelaide at 35 or 40 grand a pop. And on it goes. I'll give you thousands of examples like that. Seems crazy.
I might just speak to the quality point because it relates to one of my slides that I skipped over quite quickly. And I refer to the JAMA internal medicine paper, which has that. And you may remember that I talked about sensitive-specific definitions of appropriateness. So we are now at a watershed moment internationally where clinical groups are coming out with appropriateness criteria, and it's clinical-based groups who are deciding what's appropriate, what's uncertain, and what's inappropriate, and they're clinically led. Occasionally, there could be two august clinical bodies who have slightly different definitions of what's appropriate and what's inappropriate, and I think that's perfectly reasonable as well. So in our study, rather than we didn't see it as our role to question which of those is valid and which is invalid, we measured waste according to both. So we had a sensitive definition of waste and a specific definition. And we leave it up to the clinical and the patient communities to debate within that spectrum that there's a point estimate of appropriateness. And I think we're really just on the edge of this, and it's going to be the push from now on because so many jurisdictions internationally are moving to pay for quality, like Michael is suggesting we should do here, and I agree. But we're going to be flooded with appropriateness criteria judged by clinical groups.
Can can I also add, Adam and I are on a collectively on a, another panel that's looking at disinvestment from stuff that is of virtually or proven to have no use. And we had one of these tribal elders that I was talking about, an extraordinarily well-known orthopaedic surgeon who had been the head of the Orthopaedic Association, so elected by his peers. And he came to one of the meetings and he pointed out that for arthroscopies, there was something like 4 or 5 different Medicare codes that doctors could utilise, and the variance in funding was between, I don't quote me because I'm now, I don't know if you can remember, it was something like from $300 to $1,500 for the same procedure, depending upon what CMBS item number the doctors put there. So that would seem to me, coming back to the previous question, that would seem to me like a huge opportunity to get rid of waste.
Well, 2 more questions.
My question is to Michael. Michael, if private health insurers are allowed to play a much more active role in GP services, how can we as consumers be assured that what's currently happening in that space with other primary healthcare services that are covered by a PHI, such as physio, dental, optometry, that there won't be an increasing out-of-pocket cost for us, because that's what happens currently, and we do have private health insurance in that space.
Again, dream-like stuff, but what I put up there was changing funding models. I think, I'm very strongly of the view, but that's Michael Umbridge talking, but I think my industry thinks as well, there is an opportunity in changing the funding models to have a universal service obligation. And it would depend exactly on what the government chose to put into the USO as to what they would, what the funds would have to pay for. And if the funds decided, sorry, if the government decided with the sort of activity that Jennifer's talking about, that optometry or dental or something should be in or out, the government ought to react to that. And in fact, there would then be a requirement for funds to pay for it. However, there are a number of dilemmas with what they would pay, because the out-of-cost element of a service is actually really out of the control of the private health insurers, unless you want the premiums to keep escalating, and I know nobody does, because it's like a doctor's fee now. You know, we pay X, we are required to pay. Many funds pay a lot more than that in their preferred provider arrangements with the doctor, but then the doctors say, they're allowed to, so you know, good luck to them, I guess, but they say, well, look, I know I've got this agreement with you to provide services at the AMA rate plus 10%, but that's an agreement with you in general. My contractual relationship is with the patient who's just come through the door. And if I think they can pay twice the AMA rate, I'm not obliged to honour the contract that I've got with you for that member. So, what I'm saying is the provision of the service, optometry, whatever you mentioned in that grab bag there, could be in the USO, but I don't know that you can stop the patient co-payment, because that's price control. No, that's true. In fact, I was recently speaking to some of my colleagues internationally about this, because trying to control costs while improving quality is an international thing. This is nothing new here. And there, in particular, I think it was Ireland, I can't remember my notes, but one of them said that they had ways of enforcing that contract, which I'm going to look at. But no, it is factual that the doctors can charge what they want to for an well, not only doctors. Let's not target doctors only. The healthcare provider, despite the preferred provider relationship with the fund, can charge a different fee for the consumer.
That's the wonders of fee for service medicine.
It's Marlene Eggert from the Australian College of Nursing. I have a question for Michael, and you focus on the various treatments that are provided through doctors on a private basis. But I also wanted to raise the issue of private hospitals and the nursing care they provide. We know that nurses make a very significant contribution to the value generated in hospital care. We have the data for that. And sadly, I have to join the club of people who had very negative experiences with private hospitals, when my sister-in-law actually didn't receive the nursing care. She wouldn't be showered, she didn't get the right nutrition, she didn't get pain medication when she needed it, and she really had an awful time. And in fact, if the family hadn't been in a crisis, I would have encouraged my brother-in-law not to pay. So I just wonder whether that is on your horizon in any way.
It certainly is, but at the risk of being on the front page of every paper in Australia tomorrow, I'm not going to criticise the private hospitals. They delight in, I think they must have something in my suit or something. They seem to know. They seem to know. My phone will go in the car on the way home if I say too much. First of all, let me say I think you're 100% right. Nurses are really the backbone of the care. I mean, doctors can come in and prescribe, you know, certain drug three times a day at a certain level, but it's the nurses who do the large majority of the care for the patient, and how they provide that care is, of course, crucial to the patient experience, which my guys, the funds, know only too well. And at the risk of being a little contentious, private hospitals usually are fabulous. And most people who go into a private hospital, if you look at the, because we do, if you look at the exit surveys, they think they've had fantastic care. So I'm very sorry for your, did you say sister-in-law, I think. I'm very sorry that she didn't get what she should have. But that's not my responsibility. I don't run the hospitals, nor do my funds. All we do is we pay for the services that are provided there. Now, and as I've said on at least two occasions before, that annoys the bejesus out of us, because we have to pay. We can't say to that hospital, listen, Mr. Elshaw, you know, we've got 15 patient exit surveys here and the nurses were dreadful and did you say the food was awful and, you know, they didn't get the drugs at the right time. So we're only going to pay you one third of what we're contracted to. We're not allowed to. We get taken to court. And I don't think that's right. Yeah, well, yes. Yes, there is, absolutely. And once we start negotiating the price, now, sorry, this is not a good question just before lunch, but this is quite technical. But this is factual, and this is a real dilemma in the system, and it's one of the things that should change. There is a thing called second-tier default payments, and it is for whenever a contract is in dispute between a hospital and a fund. And the hospital can say to the fund, okay, we're in dispute, I will just take second tier default payments from you until we get back into contract. So what that means is that they get paid, and it's a percentage of an agreed number and blah, blah, blah. It's about 85 to 90%. Of what they would normally get. It's too high. There is no real incentive for the hospital to think, well, wait a minute, you know, Armitage is telling me I've got all these bad exit surveys. I, Dr. Elshaw, was the manager of this hospital. I've got to change that. Because there are 35 health funds, as I showed in my first slide, and Dr. Elshaw's hospital has got a contract with every single one of those, which means on average, three of them are being negotiated every month. So the fact that I go out of contract with Adam doesn't cause him much pain at all, particularly when he's only losing, you know, maybe 10 or 15%, and I'm not sure of the exact figure. It would depend on what my standard prices were in other hospitals, and that's why it's a bit technical. So we think, and we've made endless overtures to ministers of all persuasions over many years, that we think second-tier default payment should be a lot lower, so that when we start negotiating about poor service, lousy nursing, drugs not given, etc., the hospitals click their heels and sit up and take notice.
Thanks very much. Anybody hungry? Okay. Well, look, thank you. Ah, look, I'm right. Get your diabetes here. Thanks very much to the three speakers for tireless answering of questions. And I'm sure Michael will feel comfortable in the car on the way home with not too many phone calls. So I'd like you all to thank them, and we'll move on to lunch.